On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not news that America has a health care crisis, from President Bush's controversial prescription drug plan to state-level efforts from Massachusetts to New Mexico. Everyone's looking for a fix. Super business strategist Michael Porter says they're all just nibbling at the edges. Americans are paying way too much for care that far too often falls far short on quality, he says, and the only thing that will fix it is competition. It works in business, says the super guru, to drive down costs and drive up quality. It should work in the hospital and doctor's office, too. Critics say healthcare is different. Porter says, no, it's not. Up next on Point, beating the drum for real competition in American healthcare. First today, with a big deadline looming for seniors to sign up for the current President Bush's Medicare drug plan, we check in with NPR health correspondent Julie Rovner on who's signing up and who's not. Julie, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Who's been offered this plan and what percentage of those seniors have at this point signed up, Julie?
Well, it depends what set of numbers that you use. There's 43 million Medicare beneficiaries. According to the statistics that the government put out last week, 37 million of them now have some sort of prescription drug coverage. Now, is that through this program? No. There's about 31 million of those who are getting some help from the program, but a significant number of those, about 6 million people who have Medicare and Medicaid, were automatically enrolled. Another 5 million were on a Medicare managed care program that's now getting a government subsidy. Another about 10 million had coverage from former employers that's just continuing, and those employers are getting a subsidy. Basically, what we end up with is about 9 million people have signed themselves up, and that's out of about 16 million people that were eligible and needed to sign themselves up. So we've got somewhere between 6 and 8 million people left. Again, it's, you know, are there now 37 million of the 43 million with drug coverage? Is that a good thing? Yeah, but of the universe that was supposed to be helped by this program, only a little more than half have signed themselves up. So whether the glass is half empty or half full depends on which side of the program you're on.
That's a lot of numbers to digest.
Sorry.
No, I understand it. It's necessary. But what's the level of sign-up that's needed for this to be described accurately as a success? Or is there a certain level for this program to work at all? Does it depend on a certain level of sign-up?
It does, and that's, of course, why there is a deadline. It's not so much that it depends on a certain level of sign-up, but there needs to be a certain number of people who don't have very high drug expenses. You need healthy people to spread the risk across the very high users of drugs. And, of course, the idea is that this is an insurance program. So if you're a senior and you're not taking any drugs now, and I've been hearing that a lot this last week, they say, why should I sign up and pay a premium if I'm not going to get helped? Well, the idea is that perhaps later this year or next year or the year after, you will need the help that this program provides. In the meantime, they need you to help spread the risk across the rest of the Medicare population, since, after all, it is an insurance program. That's why there is a deadline, and that's why there are penalties if you miss the deadline.
So does this look like a big accomplishment for the Bush administration or something else?
Well, they're certainly painting it that way, and they love to, you know, make these numbers look as big as possible. But I think even after today, there's going to be a lot of, you know, potential trouble down the road. People who have drug expenses that are more than $2,250 in most cases are going to fall into this coverage gap. It's called the donut hole, and I actually heard some callers to C-SPAN this morning saying they're already in the donut hole, where they'll be paying the full price of their medications. They won't get any help, but they'll still have to pay the premiums. And they may be getting discounts because they're getting the negotiated price on those medications, but when they go in and they've been paying $20 or $30 or $40 and they suddenly go to the drugstore and they'll say, that'll be $250, please, those people aren't going to be very happy, even if they are being covered by this program. So it's not just a matter of how many people sign up. It's what the experience is of the people who are in the program.
We've seen a lot of bafflement out there. And finally, Julie, what about this deadline? There's been pressure on President Bush to extend it. He said he won't do that. Now we're reading some Congress people say, well, keep the deadline but drop the penalty, which is sort of another way of doing the same thing. Is that a hard and fast deadline or not?
Well, I think at this point the deadline is hard and fast, since it is today. This question of not enforcing the penalties has both an upside and a downside. On the one hand, the people who miss the deadline would be okay. On the other hand, the million or so people who've signed up just in these last, you know, week to 10 days, basically it says to them, well, you're a sucker. because you're signing up and now you're paying these premiums, probably not using very many drugs. But all those people who didn't do it, they're getting a reward by not having to pay the penalty. So I'm not sure how far that's going to go, although I agree. I've heard a lot of people talking about it.
Not easy to paint this one black or white or describe it as a thorough victory one way or another. But everybody's watching at this point. Julie Rovner, thank you very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Julie Rovner, health correspondent for National Public Radio. She spoke with me from Washington. We are talking this hour with big-time strategist Michael Porter about America's healthcare crisis and his competition cure. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Can forcing doctors and hospitals to more clearly compete on healthcare really fix the healthcare mess? And why do Americans now spend more and get less? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. In the studio with me is world-renowned expert on competitive strategy and economic development, Michael Porter. In 1999, Fortune magazine called him the single most important business strategist in the world, and he's still at it. He's a professor and director of the Institute for Strategy and Competitiveness at Harvard Business School. His best-known book is The Competitive Advantage of Nations. His new book is Redefining Healthcare, Creating Value-Based Competition on Results. Co-author thereof, Michael Porter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
We had you in a couple of years ago when you first got this bee in your bonnet. You've been fleshing it out quite vigorously here with your co-author, Elizabeth, is it Teisberg?
Teisberg.
And now you've got a lot to say. Let us look first, though, at the news that's so big in the headlines. We were just talking with Julie Rovner about it. I mean, you describe what we're in the midst of here as a healthcare crisis. You say we need a revolution. Okay. Exhibit A, President Bush's prescription drug coverage plan. Is this part of a revolution? Is this part of the way out of the American healthcare mess or not?
Well, I think it is best characterized as just the next short-term fix on the system. What it's basically doing is not changing anything. It's just putting more money in the system. It's paying more of the cost from government of that people are bearing. That may be a good thing, but it has nothing to do really with the solution, which has to be about the value we're getting for all this money we're spending.
So all this hubbub and it's not part of a solution? That's pretty rough.
Well, I'm sorry to say that. I mean, there's a long tradition in America of we just throw more money in the system, and if we pay more, somehow things will get better. Well, unfortunately, they haven't been getting better as we've gotten more and more evidence of the value that we're getting for the money we're spending on healthcare. The evidence is not encouraging. Quality problems just surface in more and more areas. Diagnoses are incorrect. Errors are common. Complications are numerous. And so the drug benefit, again, sort of papers over what I think are the fundamental problems here, which is the value delivered by the system.
And yet a lot of Americans know, as you clearly know, that there are problems with that system and want to see solutions. We're Washington hasn't done it. A lot of states have been stepping up and trying to do things. I mean, just all over the place. Massachusetts recently passing its big, you know, something close to universal coverage plan. Maryland with a law recently requiring large employers to pay for coverage aimed first and foremost there at Walmart. Kansas and Maine and Minnesota creating ways to help small businesses buy insurance. We've got 46 million people uninsured in this country, but states are trying to do some things. What about those efforts? Are those getting to the heart of it?
Well, I think those, in some cases, Tom, are much more getting to the heart of it. For example, I think the Massachusetts program is an extraordinary step forward. We know that in healthcare, there are really three big problems. Mm-hmm. One has to do with insurance, making sure that people have insurance. And frankly, the only thing we can have if we're ever going to have an effective system is universal mandatory insurance. One of the problems with the Bush drug benefit is that nothing in our system now is mandatory. An individual can opt in or out. And that creates a fundamental problem because often people that have income that can afford to contribute money to the system mm-hmm. opt out. Mm-hmm. In Massachusetts, we discovered that 25% or more of the people that didn't have insurance had incomes of $90,000 a year or more. They were opting out. They were young. They were healthy. And the only way insurance works is you spread the risk and spread the cost across everybody for the time someday, some hopefully a long time in the future, that you'll actually need the coverage.
So you're a business strategist. You're all about markets and competition. But you're saying even with that, universal mandated participation is a necessary foundation for any solution here?
It's absolutely fundamental to any true long-term solution. We can certainly make things better without that step. But what Massachusetts has done is it stepped to the plate on that issue. And it's actually said that the insurance is mandatory. That is, every individual needs to have insurance. And if you need help, the state will provide subsidies. But whereas other states have been going after, again, Band-Aids, you know, trying to get the large employers to put more money in, trying to get some individual group, some individual angle, the only way to address this problem is to make health insurance mandatory.
Well, and some not even going at it. Texas, 25% of residents uninsured. New Mexico, 21%. Are you saying then, though, that states, here Massachusetts has done it, others are looking at it. Is that it? Have they turned the key in the lock here? Is this the magic thing?
No,
coverage?
Tom, this is just a starting point. Because, again, if you don't have universal insurance, you introduce legions of inefficiency into the system to deal with the uninsured versus the insured, mm-hmm. free care pools, people showing up at the emergency room. But we believe that actually the insurance is only one of the three big issues. The second big issue is what's covered. You know, what should you pay for? What should your insurance pay for?
Yep.
And in this country, we have a patchwork of what are called mandates. Every state, you know, negotiates politically these mandates of what is included in a standard insurance plan. And we've got an incrustation of mandates, you know, where all kinds of interest groups with very passionate needs and concerns get a certain kind of coverage put into the standard plan.
Michael Porter, you've been taking your considerable brain power on this and working at it for a while. We talked a couple of years ago when you began to wade into these waters. You were diagnosing the problem for us. Now you're really getting more to the prescription. But take us back to the diagnosis first. What you see is the fundamental problems in the current system, and then we'll turn and look at how competition might address those. But what's the problem here?
Well, Tom, the fundamental problem is that we're not getting very good value for the money we're spending. And that's fundamentally because the system is not structured around value. There's many, many things that happen in healthcare in terms of how providers operate, how health plans behave, that really doesn't contribute to value, value being the health results or the health outcomes per dollar we spend. That's the fundamental problem. If we need to dramatically improve the value. And what's the puzzle in healthcare in America is that we have a private system. We have a system with a lot of competition, but the competition is not driving improvements in value. In fact, the evidence is horrifying in terms of higher cost and reductions in quality. So the question is, how do we get competition aligned with value instead of the competition we have today, which is fundamentally about bargaining power and cost shifting?
Now, you've earned your stripes in a wider world of competition. In most industries, what does competition produce, in your view?
In most industries, in fact, in virtually every industry we've ever looked at, competition drives improvements in value. Quality goes up, defects go down. The good providers, the good producers grow and gain market share, and the less effective producers kind of go out of business or fix their problems.
So if that was happening in American healthcare, paint a very visceral picture for us. How would it change the way a healthcare looks? You say the delivery system, healthcare delivery, is the most broken piece here. Would we see, I don't know, giant, super efficient Walmart equivalent hospitals? Would we see Americans flying to specialty centers in Dallas or Seattle or Boston for particular treatments where they were especially good? How would it physically and logistically look different than it does now?
Well, Tom, we might see all of those things. But I think what we would start by seeing is we would actually see a really redefinition of how we think about healthcare. Right now, we think about healthcare as healthcare. Actually, the relevant way to think about value in healthcare is to think about it medical condition by medical condition. Diabetes, asthma, okay. Heart failure. And we shouldn't be competing hospital to hospital or health plan to health plan. We should be competing around who can deliver the most value in addressing a patient's or customer's medical condition.
But wouldn't it be hospitals or particular doctors competing? I mean, who else?
It would be. But right now, hospitals are not organized around medical conditions. They're organized around anesthesiology and radiology and surgery. And they're organized around discrete interventions. They're organized around specialties. They're not organized also around the cycle of care. Right now, our system is structured to do discrete things, an office visit, a surgery, a rehab, rather than understand that actually value is created in healthcare over the cycle of care, and that cycle must be integrated. And you may want to use drugs, but you use drugs to avoid cost or to improve value downstream in the system. So for example, one of the problems with a prescription drug benefit is we should not be seeing drugs as separate. They're not separate. They are part of the cycle of care.
It's a whole picture here. But isn't that why it's also hard to judge competitive strength here? Because it's really over an entire lifetime at some level. Do we know until a person has reached age 70 or 80 or older if the full cycle care has really worked to the optimum?
Well, for a medical condition, we can certainly measure over relatively manageable points in time. We can see how well a diabetes patient is doing, how well their condition is being managed, whether they're having acute episodes, whether they're having to go to the hospital, whether they're needing intervention. The good providers in diabetes who manage the patient over the care cycle are able to keep the patient healthy. See, the key insight about healthcare that is obvious, but we don't think about it, the most efficient healthcare is the best quality.
Fix the problem and be done.
Right. Or keep the patient healthy. That's the most efficient thing. So if you make a mistake, that costs more. If you get the diagnosis wrong, that costs more. If the patient needs longer rehab, that costs more. So the very act of improving the quality of healthcare actually drives down the cost.
You're saying we're making a lot of mistakes right now that Americans aren't aware of or just somehow accept.
They accept, exactly, because this system is impenetrable, it's fractured, it's fragmented. Patients have to navigate a very complicated, fragmented care cycle. They have to go to this doctor and this doctor and this doctor on separate visits. They're not coordinated. They don't work together. And they're not thinking about how to improve the value. So the system of the future would look very different. A patient in America that had a serious heart problem would be able to go to the best provider in the world.
How would that happen? Would every heart treatment provider walk around with a sticker on its forehead giving its competitiveness rating? Or I go to the store to buy a new, I don't know, refrigerator, I can read in Consumer Reports who makes the best one, then I can shop at the store for the best price, and it's not that complicated. But how are you going to make competition actually work?
Well, I think you're putting your finger on one of the fundamental issues, which is what we're now measuring. And what we're now, what information we have. And the unfortunate thing is that we have very little of the information you really need to make good choices. Now, let me be clear. The consumer doesn't have to do all this. We don't believe that the consumer-driven healthcare model, where the consumer with more responsibility for paying the bill is going to fix the system.
That's kind of President Bush's impulse. My healthcare savings account and I spend it the wisest way. You're saying that's not your...
That's too simplistic. The consumer will never be able to navigate today's system. What we need to get is the system working correctly so that the customer's doctor has better information. So I want to emphasize that we don't think that the consumer alone is the solution here. We think that the nature of competition in the system has to be changed. But the point is that we need to measure results. Right now, we're not measuring results. We're measuring patient satisfaction. We're measuring whether there's the office visit was scheduled promptly. We're measuring lots of measures of the process, but we're not actually measuring results. And what we found is that in those few medical conditions, like cystic fibrosis, like organ transplants, where we actually have measured results systematically on a national basis and compared them, and we've seen dramatic improvements in value. So I think we believe that fundamental to any true reform of the healthcare system is pretty much universal reporting of results.
And then who will drive the competition? If you're saying the consumer is not going to be left on their own to evaluate and choose, who's going to judge and compare? What's the kind of blade of judgment that's going to drive the competitive dynamic here?
Well, there's two allies that will help the consumer. First of all, the consumer certainly should become informed, and we certainly advocate that. I should say healthcare is one of those very unusual products where the consumer and the doctor jointly produce the health care. Mm-hmm. A doctor without your patient's assent and cooperation can't do a good job.
Right.
It's a co-produced product. Mm-hmm. So we've got to get the consumer involved in the care delivery process and keeping themselves healthy. That's fundamental. We need to put much more responsibility on the consumer, and that's starting to happen. We can talk about that mm-hmm. later. But the patient is also going to have their primary care physician, the referring physician, who's going to help them navigate, and a health plan should be also playing that role. The health plan should be helping the consumer, the patient, find excellent providers in whatever medical condition or set of medical conditions they have.
Why isn't this happening already?
Well, because, again, we're in a fundamentally broken system where competition has really been about bargaining power and cost shifting. You know, the health plan thinks that their job is to get the biggest discount and to restrict the network so they get more bargaining power so they can push down the network for each of the hospitals,
the network of doctors and facilities.
Doctors and hospitals, mm-hmm. exactly. So, but that fundamentally doesn't create value. The value is created when the health plan informs the patient and helps the patient get to an excellent provider in whatever set of medical conditions they have. That's what's happening, not happening now. Moreover, the health plan should be the key system navigator. That is, the health plan should help the patient work through that cycle of care and make sure that information is shared and so forth. But the health plans historically have seen themselves as insurance companies,
right.
not as health companies. In fact, the whole health plan industry is sometimes called the payer industry, P-A-Y-O-R.
Mm-hmm, right.
And that phrase, that very word, is emblematic of the problem.
I can see it drives you crazy. So in Michael Porter's perfect world, we'd have a kind of manageable, navigable competition where the quality of medical services was being driven up. The cost would be driven down. Just the opposite in many ways of what's happening right now. I've got a lot of listeners who want to speak with you, Michael Porter. Let me begin to turn to them. William is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. Great discussion. I was just calling to see if you could possibly map out in a pros and cons sort of way the benefits of moving towards this competition, more capitalist-based healthcare system as opposed to, I don't know, more of a socialist or a socialized healthcare system.
So compare it to maybe what goes on in the UK or Canada or somewhere.
Yeah. Especially from practical angles, being what we and as the people will actually move towards and what we wouldn't, and why this competition market would be better as opposed to this socialist market.
Michael Porter.
Well, it's interesting. It used to be that the other advanced economies used to gloat about their healthcare systems as being so clearly superior to the United States. We're now having a decided change in perspective, and most other countries now are deeply concerned about the future of their healthcare systems, too. Many other countries have solved the insurance problem. That is, they have universal coverage. Everybody's covered, but they fundamentally haven't solved the delivery problem that I've been talking about. And in fact, they've got an even greater problem than we do because many of the delivery systems around the world are government-run systems. That is, it's government hospitals, government-employed doctors who are delivering care.
But they're showing greater longevity than the United States in a number of industrialized nations.
If all the data on comparative quality really suggests that, if you have universal primary care, that really helps your numbers, these aggregate numbers. But if you look at individual medical conditions like cancer and so forth, you'll find, for example, the UK is like hugely behind the US in cancer survival. They don't do a good job at the medical condition level. But because they have universal primary care, they do get benefits in terms of – because, see, the most high-value care of all is preventative care.
Mm-hmm.
It's managing your disease, keeping yourself well, keeping up with problems, seeing problems early. So those foreign systems that have got that dimension have a huge advantage, but they haven't solved the fundamental delivery problem downstream.
So you can't exclude that. But then look from the citizen's angle. William says, well, compare, Michael Porter, how would your competition-based system look compared to these state-run systems that he's referencing?
Well, the competition system, first of all, would give the patient and his or her doctor a choice in where actually to get their care. So if you had a problem with – you were an asthmatic person, you had asthma, you would have a choice about where to get your care. And you could choose based on convenience, but you could also choose based on really going to an excellent center that had great results and great track record in terms of delivering value on in terms of your health. And you could make that choice And see, what that competition among providers, which we think is very fundamental, rather than a monopoly provider system, we think that competition is going to drive much greater improvements in efficiency and health results than any state socialistic architected system. I mean, we only have to look at the Soviet Union. You know, the Soviet Union had a socialist system. It didn't work very well. It wasn't efficient.
But how do you get the full efficiencies of competition when this is such a segmented and in many ways localized market? I mean, somebody who has asthma problems and they're living in, I mean, you name it, rural Iowa. Are they really going to check into a hospital in Philadelphia or even Chicago for that? How far are they going to go for this treatment? Isn't competition stymied by the fact that it's structurally, geographically chopped up all over the place?
Well, Tom, it's a very good point that we have a system now that's primarily designed around local communities. And to some extent, that's necessitated by the urgency of some care, emergency
nature. That's where we live, locally.
Yeah, right. But what we find is that there's tremendous differences across locations in value, the quality and efficiency, and that for parts of the care cycle, perhaps an intervention or an acute part of the care cycle, actually traveling is much more efficient and creates much higher value than just going to the closest local provider
And not getting good care there.
And not getting good care. Because, see, getting bad care is much more expensive than getting good care. The Cleveland Clinic is much more efficient at doing heart surgery than your local community hospital that does 10 cases a year or 20 cases a year.
So are we going to have high-speed trains delivering millions of Americans all around the country to super hospitals?
We're going to have some of that. In fact, we're already starting to see international competition in healthcare delivery. We'll see some of that, and we'll see it more probably in other parts of the world than we see it in the United States. What we're going to see instead is we're going to see a somewhat of a consolidation in regions in the number of people providing each service.
Fewer, better healthcare providers.
In each medical
category.
Condition.
Yeah.
And we're going to see cross-geographic care delivery organizations. So, for example, today the Cleveland Clinic actually manages the cardiac surgery practice in Rochester, New York. At the Rochester General Hospital, one of the best cardiac centers in the world is actually managing a local provider in a particular region. We're going to see many more, I think, of those relationships where you tap into the world-class expertise and knowledge and training and standards, but actually there's multiple units of care delivered by the same world-class organization.
Is Walmart the model? Should the little ma-and-pa doctor shop be very afraid of the Michael Porter vision?
I think any provider that cannot achieve and demonstrate excellent value in whatever they're choosing to do should be concerned, I think, about the system. Right now we have a system where we have massive fragmentation. Every hospital provides virtually every service.
Whether they're good at it or not.
Whether they're good at it, we don't know. And frankly, the data tells us that we would be horrified if we really knew
how bad some of these services are.
So what we need is a system where people make choices about what services to offer based on the ability to achieve excellence rather than do a little bit of everything.
How do you line people up to participate in this competitive world you're describing?
Well, I think that we can have an extended discussion about the details of exactly how to achieve the result, but I certainly support the notion of moving to universal coverage. I think
mandatory. Everyone has to have it, and if they can't afford it?
You get support. You get help. That's where you get the voucher.
Business support or government support? Employer or government?
It probably will have to be government support at the end of the day. But having said that, I think this issue of leveling the playing field among employers is also important. Let's stay on the really core issue here. We do need competition at the health plan level. We need multiple health plans vying for your business, trying to demonstrate to you that they'll add the most value. The single payer model where there's a single government payer, Medicare giant, you know, that's not going to work.
Because there's no competition, and that's
going to do is just accentuate the bargaining power and cost shifting that's going on today. I want to emphasize we already have competition in healthcare. It's not like we have a monopoly. We have lots of providers.
But say it's the wrong kind.
It's the wrong kind of competition, and it's not structured the right way to deliver value. So I think that the directions of that proposal are certainly consistent with very, very important pieces of the problem. But fundamentally, we've got to wade into the issue of how we address the delivery of care. If we don't do that, none of this other stuff is going to ultimately make any difference. We're going to end up having the next prescription drug benefit and the next tax subsidy and the next scheme to help people pay for their insurance. We've got to get the value right or it's going to bankrupt us.
Well, we'd all like to get the value right. On the other hand, we know the competitive world can be pretty overwhelming sometimes as well when you're trying to choose between options here. Mary's calling from Peabody, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I work in healthcare. I'm also a patient from time to time. Mm-hmm. And what bothers me so much about this conversation and these kinds of strategies is that it avoids the essential component of healthcare, which is it is a service based on relationship, my relationship to my doctor and my relationship to the patients that I see. When I hear all of this talk about business principles applied to healthcare, it makes me recoil because, you know, we are not talking about widgets here. And that is, I think, one of the major problems that these businessmen don't take into consideration.
Mary, would you stick with us for a second here? Michael Porter says very high in his book that this is the response he gets very often from the medical community. I want him to speak to it. But, Mary, hang in here with us for a moment. Michael Porter, we're not widgets. Competition won't put us in the right place here.
We're absolutely not. And relationships are fundamental. And they're not only fundamental between the doctor and the patient, they're fundamental between the doctor and the doctor and the doctor and the nurse that should be coordinating and integrating the care for a patient. But so the relationship problems, I think, are just as important there. And of course, the way the system is structured now, if you work in healthcare, you're well aware of this, that when one doctor does his or her job, then the patient gets passed on to another. And the integration and coordination of care doesn't always occur. We believe that there's nothing about a system in which you actually have to choose between competing providers that have to demonstrate excellence that goes any way against the notion of relationships. If relationships are fundamental to a care delivery team doing their job, we're going to have better relationships in this new system than we do in the current system, where now you see a doctor for 5 minutes and you're gone.
Mary, what do you say to that?
Well, I'm not convinced.
Why not?
You know, I continued to – one of my pet peeves is receiving glossy brochures and magazines from various providers in my area, all competing to try to get me to become their patient.
Mm-hmm.
I can cite one example. Prestigious hospital in my area sends me a magazine with information that I find useless.
And you're thinking this just drives up their costs but doesn't get me better care, perhaps.
Right. And it's an allocation of funds to a PR department, and I happen to be talking to the wife of one of my patients whose husband was admitted to this particular hospital, and she described to me nightmare stories about the nursing care.
So the face can be great, but whether or not they actually deliver is another issue. Mary, I want to get another caller or two here, if I may. I thank you for your call. David's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call, and it's a real honor to be able to speak to Dr. Porter, not to mention you, Tom.
Oh, okay.
I'm a real admirer of what I hear Dr. Porter talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder how we make the transition from today to the goals that you're setting out, Dr. Porter.
Do you think medicine, the world of medicine, will embrace this transition, David?
In essence, yes. I know that there was a lot of effort in the 90s to move towards gatekeeper models, which is essentially what I hear Dr. Porter talking about. And not only did insurance companies resist that, but primary care physicians greatly resisted that.
And consumers weren't so happy about it either, patients.
Well, I think if you rely on what the last caller was talking about, if you build that up as in a way of relationships, I think consumers can overcome that. But the question is, the training of primary care physicians today does not have them overseeing cardiothoracic surgeons and oncologists, and that's what we're asking them to do, to go to this kind of model or to a capitation model.
David, let us pick that up. Michael Porter, how is the big question? How do you get to this? There's so many interests. You describe many at length in the book, interlocking and resistant. David says, you know, how do you get it done?
Well, first of all, David, thanks for calling. I haven't communicated well if you're equating my thinking here with gatekeeping. The gatekeeper model was a sort of an effort to do top-down management of what doctors do by having somebody that had to approve every treatment or every referral. And we believe that that model will never work. That is, we don't want to try to micromanage the providers. What we need to do instead is we need to get them to measure and have to demonstrate good results. And we believe that restricted networks, where you can only go to a certain provider because that provider is in the network and you get a substantial incentive to do that, we think that restricted networks are, again, a bad approach. Instead, we believe that people need the information about results in order for they and their doctor to jointly decide where they want to get their care, depending on their
medical condition.
We've got
just a couple of minutes. How would that work? Are there examples now? Is every care provider going to wear a number, a rating on its forehead to help me decide? How would it work?
Well, we have, first of all, the how question, I think, this is already happening, this revolution. It's just happening on a scale that is not very apparent to most consumers. We have hospital groups like the Cleveland Clinic who have organized their care around the cycle of care, who have developed focused entities that are integrated in particular medical conditions that deliver marvelous results, world-class results. But they tend to be now the exceptions. We have MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, a world-class center that is organized appropriately. We have lots of examples of health plans that are starting to move to the idea rather than the typical network, they're starting to move to what they call quality networks, where they work to identify providers that are excellent in quality and value.
We've got 1 minute. Steps A, B, C. Government has to require universal coverage, and then how do you make it take off?
I think we believe that much of this can actually happen from within. However, if government had one
Not
wand,
now.
If government would wave one wand, it would be the wand of information, measuring outcomes, measuring results on a medical condition by medical condition level.
Standard rating system of some kind.
Right. And it's things like mortality rates, complication rates, rehab, readmissions, things that really measure the true results of that intervention.
So require coverage and measure or rate performance.
That's correct. And we also ultimately believe that government has to move away a lot of the incrustations that are getting in the way of productive competition. For example, right now, each doctor is licensed in each state. That makes it hard to efficiently compete across geography, which would be probably a good thing in the long run.
Michael Porter, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, the class of Katrina, Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush at Tulane University. This is On Point. New Orleans celebrated new beginnings this weekend with the graduation of over 2,200 students at Tulane University. Former Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton delivered the graduation keynote addresses. After Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, the presidents formed the Bush-Clinton-Katrina Fund, which has raised over $100 million to date. Bush kicked off the duo's joint appearance, telling the audience that in the face of every Tulane graduate, he sees hope for New Orleans' future.
A lot of people out there like to talk about the cynical times in which we live. But as I look around this room and bask in the warmth of your welcome, I still believe there are people out there who care, who are willing to open their hearts to the pain and the need around them, and do the hard work that makes a positive difference in our world. I still believe there are people out there who seek a higher purpose to serve with their lives during our time together on this earth. And when I look at what happened along the Gulf Coast, I still believe in heroes. When I look at our world, the good I see far outweighs the bad, which maybe explains why I'm a real optimist about the future that you all will be facing. Let me put it this way. Back during my Navy days, World War II, Navy pilots had a saying, not to describe a cloudless, perfect flying day. It says, ceiling and visibility unlimited. CAVU. I made a plaque up in, I put it in our house in Maine. Barbara said, "What's that doing?" I said, "Never mind. That's a plaque I'm putting on here. It reminds me of something very important. Ceiling and visibility unlimited." And that's what you wanted to hear when you were climbing into your plane and preparing for the mission ahead, that the skies were clear. So such is my wish for each of you as you prepare to leave Tulane to tackle the challenges of life ahead. I wish all your days will be blessed with ceiling and visibility unlimited. Lord knows I'll be pulling for you, so get out there and make us all proud. Thank you very, very much.
Former President George H.W. Bush speaking at Tulane University. Former President Bill Clinton picked up where Bush left off.
You will be happier if you cultivate what one theologian has called the discipline of gratitude to your family, your teachers, to those whose service makes your lives better, who are often overlooked, to people who clean your streets and maintain your buildings and serve your food in restaurants. Being grateful in a constant way reminds us that no matter how bad things are, there are a lot of people who are profoundly worse off, and gives us the courage to go on. My second piece of advice is to dream your dreams and try to live them. For life's largest disappointments are not rooted in failures or mistakes. Anybody who's lived long enough has made a fair share of both. The greatest disappointments are in the absence of passionate commitment and effort, the sense of not having tried. You may not end up exactly where you want to go in life, but following your stars will guarantee you a marvelous journey, and it will enable you to begin again. When I think of all you in this great city I have loved all my life have endured, I'm reminded of a phrase that Ernest Hemingway made famous: life breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places. The invocation today was a Dixieland rendition of "Just a Closer Walk with Thee." It was breathtakingly beautiful. And it was done just the way Dixieland bands have done it forever in New Orleans, in a low, grieving, moaning, beautiful dirge. And then at the end of a funeral service, a new beginning in fast, happy Dixieland rhythm. Life's like that. It is always about new beginnings. I wish you many. God bless you.
Former President Bill Clinton, he delivered the joint keynote address with George H.W. Bush at the commencement ceremonies at Tulane University. We go out with the song Clinton mentioned, "Just a Closer Walk with Thee," performed at Tulane on Saturday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.